that the Ukrainians would have to have the prosecutor general make a statement with respect to the investigations as a condition of having the aid lifted.
And you testified that you were not comfortable with what Ambassador Sondland had told you. Why not?
Well, I was concerned about what I saw as essentially an additional hurdle to accomplishing what I had been directed to help accomplish, which was giving the president the information he needed to determine that the security sector assistance could go forward.
So now there's a whole other wrinkle to it, right?
There was the appearance of one based on what Ambassador Sondland represented.
And you told Ambassador Taylor about this conversation as well, is that right?
I promptly reached out to Ambassador Taylor to schedule a secure phone call.
And in your deposition, you testified that his testimony, other than one small distinction between President Zelensky and the Prosecutor General, was accurate as to what you told him. Is that correct?
About that conversation, yes.
And generally speaking, you confirmed everything that Ambassador Taylor told you, except for that one thing and a small other ministerial matter relating to the location of a meeting. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, did you tell Ambassador Bolton about this conversation as well?
I reached out to him as well and requested his availability for a secure phone call.
And what was his response when you explained to him what Ambassador Sondland had said?
Tell the lawyers.
Did you go tell the lawyers?
When I returned to the States, yes.
And did he explain to you why he wanted you to tell the lawyers?
He did not.
Al, this wasn't the first time, and it wouldn't be the last, that Ambassador Bolton instructed other government officials to report details of the president's scheme to White House lawyers. Now, let's be clear, when government employees have concerns about whether something is legal, they often go to their agency's lawyers. And it was happening an awful lot around this time. Recall that Bolton also instructed Dr. Hill to report to the lawyers Sondland's statements about requiring an announcement of the investigations as a condition for a White House meeting. What Bolton called Sondland's, quote, drug deal with the president's top aide, Mick Mulvaney. Ambassador Bolton's testimony would obviously shine further light on these concerns and what or who, if anyone, at the White House or the cabinet did to try to stop the president at this time. After the president's hold on military aid became public in late August, there was increasing pressure on the president to lift the hold. On September 3rd, a bipartisan group of senators sent a letter to acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. And an excerpt from that letter is in front of you. The senators expressed, quote, deep concerns that the, quote, administration is considering not obligating the Ukraine Security Initiative funds for 2019. The senator's letter also urged that the vital funds be obligated immediately. On September 5th, the chairman and the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee sent a joint letter to Mulvaney and OMB Director Russell Vaught. That letter also expressed deep concern about the continuing hold on the military aid. The same day, Senators Murphy and Johnson visited Kyiv and met with President Zelensky along with Ambassador Taylor.
On September 5th, I accompanied Senators Johnson and Murphy during their visit to Kyiv. When we met with President Zelensky, his first question to the senators was about the withheld security assistance. My recollection of the meeting is that both senators stressed that bipartisan support for Ukraine in Washington was Ukraine's most important strategic asset, and that President Zelensky should not jeopardize that bipartisan support by getting drawn in to U.S. domestic politics. I had been making and continue to make this point to all of my official Ukrainian contacts, but the odd push to make President Zelensky publicly commit to investigations of Burisma and alleged interference in the 2016 election showed how the official foreign policy of the United States was undercut by the irregular efforts led by Mr. Giuliani.
The senator sought to reassure President Zelensky that there was bipartisan support in Congress for providing the military aid. Also on September 5th, the Washington Post editorial board reported concerns that President Trump was withholding the aid. and a meeting to force President Zelensky to announce investigations to benefit his personal political campaign. The editors wrote, quote, "We're reliably told that the president has a second and more venal agenda. He is attempting to force Mr. Zelensky to intervene in the 2020 U.S. presidential election by launching an investigation of the leading Democratic candidate, Joe Biden. Mr. Trump is not just soliciting Ukraine's help with his presidential campaign, he is using U.S. military aid the country desperately needs in an attempt to extort it," end quote. Despite these efforts to get the president to lift the hold, in the now public discussion about the president's abuse of power, the scheme continued. 2 days later, on September 7th, Morrison went back to White House lawyers to report additional details he had learned from Ambassador Sondland about the president's scheme, again, at the direction of Ambassador Bolton.
Now, a few days later, on September 7th, you spoke again to Ambassador Sondland, who told you that he had just gotten off the phone with President Trump. Isn't that right?
That sounds correct, yes.
What did Ambassador Sondland tell you that President Trump said to him?
If I recall this conversation correctly, this was where Ambassador Sondland related that there was no quid pro quo, but President Zelensky had to make the statement and that he had to want to do it.
And by that point, did you understand that the statement related to the Biden and 2016 investigations?
I think I did, yes.
And that was essentially a condition for the security assistance to be released?
I understood that that's what Ambassador Sondland believed.
After speaking with President Trump?
That's what he represented.
Now, you testified that hearing this information gave you a sinking feeling. Why was that?
Well, I believe if we're on September 7th, the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, these are one-year dollars, DOD and the Department of State funds. So we only had so much time. And in fact, because Congress imposed a 15-day notification requirement on the State Department funds, September 7th, September 30th, that really means September 15th, in order to secure a decision from the president to allow the funds to go forward.
Did you tell Ambassador Bolton about this conversation as well?
I did, yes.
And what did he say to you?
He said to tell the lawyers.
And why did he say to tell the lawyers?
He did not explain his direction.
Again, tell the lawyers. Ambassador Sondland's call with President Trump on September 7th also prompted deep concern by Ambassador Taylor, which you've already heard about. On September 8th and 9th, Ambassador Taylor exchanged WhatsApp messages with Ambassador Sondland and Volker describing his, quote, nightmare scenario, that, quote, they give the interview and don't get the security assistance. As he then goes on to say, quote, the Russians love it and I quit. After the hold on the military aid became public, the White House took two actions in early September. First, the White House and the Justice Department ensured that the acting DNI continued to withhold the whistleblower complaint from Congress in clear violation of the law. And second, the White House attempted to create a cover story for the president's withholding of the assistance, approximately 2 months after President Trump had ordered the freeze. Mark Sandy received an email from his boss, Michael Duffy, that for the first time, gave a reason for the hold. Sandy testified that in early September, he received an email from Duffy, quote, that attributed the hold to the president's concern about other countries not contributing more to Ukraine. Again, after months of scrambling, this was the first time any reason had been provided for the hold. And according to Sandy, it was also only in early September, again, after the White House learned of the whistleblower complaint and the hold became public, that the White House requested data from OMB on other countries' assistance to Ukraine. So let's recap why we know the concern about burden sharing was bogus. First, for months, no reason was given to the very people executing the military aid, who had been actively searching for answers about why the aid was being held. Second, remember the supposed interagency process performed by OMB? Well, it was fake. And third, after the hold went public and the White House became aware of the whistleblower, they started scrambling to develop another excuse. Public reports confirm this. A November 24th news report, for instance, revealed that in September, Mr. Cipollone's lawyers conducted an internal records review. The review reportedly, quote, turned up hundreds of documents that reveal extensive efforts to generate an after-the-fact justification for the decision in a debate over whether the delay was legal. The president's top aides were trying to convince the president to lift the hold in late August and early September. And White House officials were actively working to develop an excuse for the president's scheme and devise a cover story in the event that it was exposed. And soon it would be. On September 9th, the chairs of the House Intelligence Committee, the Committee on Foreign Affairs, and the Committee on Oversight and Reform publicly announced the joint investigation of President Trump and Mr. Giuliani's scheme. And this is when the music stops and everyone starts running to find a chair. Word of the committee's investigation spread quickly through the White House to the NSC. Morrison recalled seeing and discussing the letter with NSC staff. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman also recalled discussions among NSC staff members, including Morrison's deputy John Arath, about the investigation. The same day, there were efforts at OMB to create a paper trail that tried to shift the blame for the president's hold on security assistance away from the White House. Duffy sent an email to Elaine McCusker that contradicted months of email exchanges. It stated falsely that OMB had in fact authorized DOD to proceed with all process necessary to obligate funds. Duffy was attempting to shift all the responsibility for the delay onto the Pentagon. McCusker replied, and I quote, "You can't be serious. I am speechless." Now, all of this, including OMB's efforts to shift blame to the Pentagon, the White House's effort to create a cover story for the hold on security assistance, were a continuation of the cover-up. It started with the White House's lawyers' failure to stop the scheme after the July 10th meeting was reported to them, continued with attempts to hide the July 25th call summary, and escalated with the White House's illegal concealment of the whistleblower complaint from Congress. On September 10th, the House Intelligence Committee requested that the DNI provide a copy of the whistleblower complaint as the law requires. But DNI continued to withhold the complaint for weeks. The same day, it was announced that Ambassador Bolton was resigning or had been fired. It is unclear whether Ambassador Bolton's departure from the White House had anything to do with his opposition to the hold on military aid. But of course, Ambassador Bolton could shed light on that himself if he were to testify. The next day, on September 11th, President Trump met with Vice President Pence, Mulvaney, and Senator Portman to discuss the hold. Later that day, the president relented and lifted the hold after his scheme had been exposed. The president's decision to release the aid, just like his decision to impose the hold, was never explained. Cooper testified that President Trump's lifting of the hold, quote, really came out of the blue. It was quite abrupt. The only logical conclusion based on all of this evidence is that the president lifted the hold on September 11th because he got caught. The president's decision to lift the hold without any explanation is also very telling. If the hold was put in place for legitimate policy reasons, why lift it arbitrarily with no explanation? By lifting the hold only after Congress had launched an investigation, when, as Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified, none of the facts on the ground had changed since the hold had been put into place, the president was conceding that there was never a legitimate purpose. Since the hold was lifted, the president has paid lip service to purported concerns about corruption and burden sharing. But the administration has taken no concrete steps before or since those statements were made to show that it really cares. The record is clear. Before he got caught, the president had no interest in anti-corruption reforms in Ukraine. And as you've already learned, those people who really were concerned about these issues, like Congress, this Senate, the DOD, and the State Department, had already gone through the process to address them. As Ambassador Sondland testified, at no point did the president ask him to discuss additional contributions to Ukraine from EU countries, nor did President Trump push Ukraine to undertake any specific anti-corruption reforms. Now, the president's counsel will likely say that his lifting of the hold shows his good faith. They will say that because Ukraine ultimately received the aid without President Zelensky having to announce the sham investigations, that there was no abuse of power. As a legal matter, the fact that the president's corrupt scheme was not fully successful makes no difference. Trump's abuse occurred at the moment he used the power of the presidency to assist his reelection campaign, undermining our free and fair elections and our national security. But importantly, President Trump almost did get away with it. As discussed earlier, President Zelensky agreed during his September phone call with Ambassador Sondland to do a CNN interview during which he denounced the investigations. On September 12th, Ambassador Taylor personally informed President Zelensky and the Ukrainian foreign minister that President Trump's hold on military assistance had been lifted. And on September 13th, Ambassador Taylor and David Holmes met with President Zelensky and his advisors and urged them not to go forward with the CNN interview. It was not until September 18th and 19th, around the time that President Zelensky spoke with Vice President Pence, that the Ukrainians finally canceled the CNN interview. The president has also repeatedly pointed to President Zelensky's public statements that he did not feel pressured by Trump. Not only unsurprising, it's also irrelevant. The question is whether President Trump used the power of the presidency to coerce President Zelensky into helping him win a political campaign. But we know that President Zelensky was pressured. He kept delaying and delaying because he did not want to be a pawn in U.S. domestic politics. In fact, President Zelensky remains under pressure to this day. As Holmes testified, there are still things the Ukrainians want and need from the United States, including a meeting with the president in the Oval Office, which has still not been scheduled. And yes, Ukraine remains at war and needs U.S. military aid, including aid that is still delayed from last year. For these reasons, Mr. Holmes explained, quote, I think the Ukrainians are being very careful. They still need us now going forward. In fact, right now, President Zelensky is trying to arrange a summit meeting with President Putin in the coming weeks, his first face-to-face meeting with him to try to advance the peace process. He needs our support. He needs President Putin to understand that America supports Zelensky at the highest levels. So this doesn't end with the lifting of the security assistance hold. Ukraine still needs us, and as I said, still fighting this war this very day. When President Trump, for his own personal political gain, asked for a favor from President Zelensky, he did exactly what the framers feared most. He invited the influence of a foreign power into our elections. He used the power of his office to secure that advantage and jeopardized our national security. Yet President Trump maintains that he was always in the right and that his July 25th call with President Zelensky was perfect. President Trump has made it clear that he believes he is free to use his powers the same way, to the same ends, whenever and wherever he pleases. And even more troubling, he's even doubling down on his abuse, inviting other countries to interfere in our elections. What does all of this tell you? It tells you that Ambassador Sondland was correct when he told Holmes after hanging up with President Trump on July 26th that the president doesn't care about Ukraine. He only cares about the, quote, big stuff, meaning stuff that helps him personally. The bottom line is that the president used the powers of his office for personal political gain. He did so knowingly, deliberately, and repeatedly. And his misconduct continues to this day.
Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Today is the third and final day for oral arguments from the Democratic House floor managers. We just heard from Democratic Representative Jason Crow of Colorado. We now turn back to the lead impeachment manager, Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of Southern California.
Senators, just for your orientation, this will be the last presentation on Article 1. And Mr. Leader, I think at the conclusion of this presentation will be a logical point to take a break. This last section on Article 1 deals with the injury to our national interest and our national security. When President Trump used Ukraine's leader for a political favor and withheld critical military aid to an ally in exchange for that favor, he did exactly what our framers feared most. He invited foreign interference in our elections and sold out our country's security for his personal benefit and betrayed the nation's trust to a foreign power. The president's scheme to pressure Ukraine to do his political dirty work harmed our national security, undermined our free and fair elections, and even today, threatens the very foundation of our democracy. When the president argues that his call was perfect, that he did nothing wrong, what he's really saying is that there's nothing wrong with the president asking a foreign government to do a personal favor. That there's nothing wrong with the president pressuring that foreign country to interfere in our elections for his personal benefit. That there's nothing wrong with withholding congressionally appropriated, taxpayer-funded military assistance to that foreign country to extort that country to help the president cheat to win an election. But there are a great many things wrong with that. Most significant for the purposes that bring us here today, the Constitution does not permit it. And the Constitution does not permit it because that conduct is the quintessential abuse of power. The use of official power for personal gain, putting personal interest over the national interest, and placing personal benefits over our nation's security. The president's conduct that we outlined yesterday harmed our national security. That is without a doubt. It endangered our elections and it sent our country on a dangerous path that, if left unchecked, will cause irrevocable damage to the balance of power contemplated in our Constitution. If someone sacrifices the national interest in favor of his own and is not removed from office, our democracy is in jeopardy. It's just that simple. The grave consequences of President Trump's misconduct demand our attention. Let me take these issues in turn, beginning with this harm to national security. First, the president's abuse of power had immediate consequences to our security. Ukraine is a burgeoning democracy entangled in a hot war with Russia. By withholding military aid, President Trump not only denied Ukraine much-needed military equipment, but also weakened Ukraine's position in negotiations over the end of the war with Russia. Because of President Trump's corrupt actions, Vladimir Putin was emboldened at a pivotal moment ahead of those sensitive negotiations to attempt to end the war. And emboldened Russia is a threat to the United States and global security around the world. The president's willingness to put himself over country undercut our European allies' confidence in America's commitment to deterring Russian aggression. And it signaled to adversaries and friends alike that the president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, our commander-in-chief, could be influenced by manipulating his perception of what was best for his personal interests. Now, I have no doubt that the Russians and probably every other nation that has the capacity does a psychological profile of the President of the United States, as we profile other leaders. If a president can be so easily manipulated to disbelieve his own intelligence agencies, to accept the propaganda of the Kremlin, that is a threat to our national security. And that is just what has happened here. But that's not all. President Trump's willingness to entangle our foreign allies in a corrupt political errand also undermined the credibility of Americans to promote the rule of law and fight corruption abroad. This is Trump first, not American first, not American ideals first. And the result has and will continue to be grave harm to our nation if this chamber does not stand up and say it is wrong. If you do not stand up and say this is not only wrong, not only unacceptable, but conduct incompatible with the office of the presidency. And if it really is incompatible with the office of the presidency, if you cannot faithfully execute that responsibility, if you cannot bring yourself to put your nation's interests ahead of your own, it must be impeachable, or the nation remains at risk. Let's consider the big picture here, and probably a question many people around the country are asking. Why does Ukraine matter to the United States? Why does Ukraine matter to the United States? Because we're talking about a small country that many people know very little about. Well, this small country, this ally of ours, is a country hungry for reform and eager for a stronger relation with its most powerful, important ally, the United States. And we're talking about ourselves and what it means to the strength of our own democracy and democracies around the world when countries like Ukraine are fighting our fight against authoritarianism. At least that used to be our fight. And God help us if it's not our fight still. Russian President Putin declared the collapse of the Soviet Union to be the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Ukraine's vote for independence in December 1991 was the final nail in the Soviet Union's coffin. That made Ukraine's greatest moment Putin's greatest tragedy. When it declared independence from Soviet domination, Ukraine inherited roughly 1,900 Soviet nuclear warheads, enough firepower to level every major American city several times over. 1,900 Soviet nuclear warheads. In exchange for Ukraine surrendering this arsenal, the United States, Russia, and the United Kingdom reached an understanding called the Budapest Memorandum of 1994. They committed in this memorandum to respecting the borders of an independent Ukraine, and also to refrain from using the threat or use of force against Ukraine. This was an early success of the post-Cold War period. Despite its commitment to respect Ukraine's independence, of course, Russia continued to meddle in Ukraine's affairs. Ambassador Taylor recounted how events took an even more sinister turn in 2013.
The West. But in 2013, Vladimir Putin was so threatened by the prospect of Ukraine joining the European Union that he tried to bribe the Ukrainian president. This triggered mass protests in the winter of 2013 that drove that president to flee to Russia in February 2014, but not before his forces killed 100 Ukrainian protesters in central Kyiv.
Angered by the fall of the Kremlin-backed leader in Kyiv, President Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine, specifically a region known as Crimea. Russia's aggression was met with global condemnation. Thank you.
Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald
Trump.
There,
but you can see the images of that conflict on the screens before
difficulty.
You.
This is Adam Schiff.
Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Laura Cooper testified as to the stakes for U.S. national security.
Russia violated the sovereignty of Ukraine's territory. Russia illegally annexed territory that belonged to Ukraine. They also denied Ukraine access to its naval fleet at the time. And to this day, Russia is building a capability on Crimea designed to expand Russian military power projection far beyond the immediate region.
In 2014, were there concerns in Washington, here in Washington, and European capitals that Russia might not stop in Ukraine?
I was not in my current position in 2014, but it is my understanding that there was significant fear about where Russian aggression would stop.
One American, a war hero and statesman who is no stranger to this body, recognized the threat posed by Russia's invasion of Crimea, Senator John McCain. In an interview, he declared, quote, "We are all Ukrainians." Senator McCain advised that this is a chess match reminiscent of the Cold War, and we need to realize that and act accordingly. He was, of course, absolutely right. Consistent with the commitments made to Ukraine in 1994, the United States and Europe responded to Russia's invasion by imposing significant sanctions on Russia. We joined Europe in providing Ukraine billions of dollars in economic support to help it resist Russian influence. And the Senate approved by an overwhelming bipartisan majority vital security assistance to help rebuild Ukraine's military, which the former Russian-backed leader of Ukraine had starved of resources. This strong bipartisan support for Ukraine reflected what Senator McCain said was an opportunity for the United States to undermine Russian leverage in Eastern Europe by building, quote, a success in Ukraine. Senator McCain outlined this vision.
Putin also sees, here's this beautiful and large and magnificent country called Ukraine. And suppose Ukraine finally, after failing in 2004, gets it right, democracy, gets rid of corruption, economy's really improving, and it's right there on the border of Russia. And so I think it makes him very nervous if there were a success in Ukraine in bringing about a free and open society and economic success, which is not the case in Russia, as you know, which is propped up by energy.
Achieving the Ukrainian success that Senator McCain and many of us hoped for proved to be a daunting task. But several witnesses who testified before the House said Vladimir Zelensky's landslide election in April 2019 was a game changer. Here is how U.S. diplomat David Holmes explained the, quote, historic opportunity created by his election.
Despite the Russian aggression over the past 5 years, Ukrainians have rebuilt a shattered economy, adhered to a peace process, and moved economically and socially closer to the West, toward our way of life. Earlier this year, large majorities of Ukrainians again chose a fresh start by voting for a political newcomer as president, replacing 80% of their parliament, and endorsing a platform consistent with our democratic values, our reform priorities, and our strategic interests. This year's revolution at the ballot box underscores that despite its imperfections, Ukraine is a genuine and vibrant democracy and an example to other post-Soviet countries and beyond, from Moscow to Hong Kong.
Support for Ukraine's security and reform is critical not only to our own national security, but that to other allies and emerging democracies around the world. The widely accepted fact of Ukraine's importance to our national security makes President Trump's abuse of power and withholding of vital diplomatic and military support all the more disturbing. First, witnesses assess that withholding the military aid likely helped to prolong the war against Russia. When wars drag on, More people die. Ambassador Taylor testified to this sober reality.
I take it if the provision of U.S. military assistance would save Ukrainian lives, that any delay in that assistance may also cost Ukrainian lives. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, of course, it's hard to draw any direct lines between any particular element of security assistance and any particular death on the battlefield. But it is certainly true that that assistance had enabled Ukrainian armed forces to be effective and deter and to be able to take countermeasures to the attacks that the Russians had.
And I think you said that a Ukrainian soldier lost their life while you were visiting Donbas.
We keep very careful track of the casualties, and I noticed on the next day the information that we got that one was killed, four soldiers were wounded on that day.
And indeed, Ukrainians lose their lives every week.
Every week.
David Holmes also testified that prolonging the war in Ukraine results in additional casualties.
As we sit here today, Ukrainians are fighting a hot war on Ukrainian territory against Russian aggression. This week alone, since I have been here in Washington, two Ukrainian soldiers were killed and two injured by Russian-led forces in eastern Ukraine, despite a declared ceasefire. I learned overnight that seven more were injured yesterday.
Withholding the aid has real consequences to real soldiers with real families. And bear in mind that U.S. aid is fully 10% of Ukraine's defense budget. 10%. That's not an extra bonus. That's necessary aid for Ukraine to defend itself on the front line. Now, a second consequence of President Trump's withholding of military assistance was that it emboldened Russia, our adversary. Here is Laura Cooper, a Pentagon official who oversaw the military aid.
What about today? If the U.S. were to withdraw its military support of Ukraine, what would effectively happen?
It is my belief that if we were to withdraw our support, it would embolden Russia. It would also validate Russia's violation of international law.
And which country stands to benefit the most, would stand to benefit the most from such a withdrawal?
Russia.
Russia was not only emboldened on the battlefield. Ambassador Taylor testified that President Trump's corrupt withholding of military assistance and his failure to host President Zelensky in the Oval Office was, quote, a sign of weakness to Moscow. And it harmed Ukraine's negotiating position, even as recently as December 9, when Zelensky and Putin met to discuss the conflict in the East, shown in this photo. Ambassador Taylor explained.
I think you also testified that Russia was watching closely to gauge the level of American support for the Ukrainian government. Why is that significant?
This is significant, Mr. Chairman, because the Ukrainians, in particular under this new administration, are eager to end this war. And they are eager to end it in a way that the Russians leave their territory. These negotiations, like all negotiations, are difficult. Ukrainians would like to be able to negotiate from a position of strength, or at least more strength than they now have. Part of that strength, part of the ability of the Ukrainians to negotiate against the Russians, with the Russians for an end to the war in Donbas, depends on the United States and other international support. If we withdraw or suspend or threaten to withdraw our security assistance, that's a message to the Ukrainians, but it's at least as important as your question indicates, Mr. Chairman, to the Russians, who are looking for any sign of weakness or any sign that we are withdrawing our support for Ukraine.
And so when the Ukrainians learned of the suspension of the military aid, either privately or when others learned publicly, the Russians would be learning also. And they would take that as a lack of robust U.S. support for Ukraine. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
And that would weaken Ukraine in negotiating an end to the war in Donbas.
It would.
Indeed, the aid doesn't just supply much-needed weapons to Ukraine. It is a symbol of support, a signal of strength, a signal of the backing of the United States. And withholding that aid, even for a period of time, undermined all of those things. President Trump's actions towards Ukraine also undercut worldwide confidence in the United States as a reliable security partner. Maintaining that confidence is crucial to the strength of our alliances in Europe, to deterring Russia, and ultimately protecting and projecting democracy around the world. The United States has roughly 68,000 troops stationed in Europe. They serve alongside troops from 28 other countries that comprise the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. They are holding the line against further Russian aggression. It was U.S. leadership that led to the creation of NATO 70 years ago as the Iron Curtain was descending across the heart of Europe. And it is American leadership that makes NATO work today. NATO is also effective because other countries, friends and foes alike, know that we are committed to our collective defense, that an attack against one nation is an attack against all of us. That principle deterred a Russian invasion of Europe during the Cold War. It's only been invoked once by NATO in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. New York is a long way from the front lines with Russia, but our European allies stood with us after that dark day. They deployed tens of thousands of troops to Afghanistan and joined us in fighting the Al-Qaeda terrorists who attacked the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. Now, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, but Russia's invasion of Ukraine was a threat to the peace and security of Europe. Moscow's aggression threatened the rules of the road that have kept the peace in Europe since World War II, the sacrosanct idea that borders cannot be changed by military force. If we had not supported Ukraine in 2014, if members of this body had not voted overwhelmingly on a bipartisan basis for military assistance to rebuild Ukraine's military, there is no question it would have invited further Russian adventurism in Ukraine and perhaps elsewhere in the heart of Europe. It would have weakened our allies and exposed U.S. troops stationed in Europe to greater danger. Deterring Russia requires persistence, not just one military aid package or one Oval Office meeting, but a sustained policy of support for our partners. We only deter Russia by consistently demonstrating support for our friends, friends like Ukraine. George Shultz, who served as Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, understood this. He compared diplomacy and alliance management to gardening. He said, quote, "If you plant a garden and go away for 6 months, what have you got when you come back? Weeds." Diplomacy, he said, is kind of like that. You go around, talk to people, you develop a relationship of trust and confidence, and then if something comes up, you have that base to work from. President Trump's decision to transform the military aid and Oval Office meeting into leverage was the equivalent of trampling all over George Shultz's garden, crushing Ukraine's confidence in the United States as a partner. He also caused our NATO allies to question whether we would stand with them against Russia. Leaders in European capitals now wonder whether personal political favors and not treaty obligations guide our foreign policy. Colleagues, this is how alliances wither and die, and how Russia wins. Ambassador Taylor made clear that is why it is so important to our security that we stand with Ukraine.
Mr. Chairman, as my colleague, Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent described, we have a national security policy, a national defense policy that identifies Russia and China as adversaries. The Russians are violating all of the rules, treaties, understandings that they committed to that actually kept the peace in Europe for nearly 70 years. Until they invaded Ukraine in 2014, they had abided by sovereignty of nations, of inviolability of borders. That rule of law, that order that kept the peace in Europe and allowed for prosperity as well as peace in Europe was violated by the Russians. And if we don't push back on that, on those violations, then that will continue. And that, Mr. Chairman, affects us. It affects the world that we live in, that our children will grow up in, and our grandchildren. This affects the kind of world that we want to see overall. So that affects our national interests very directly. Ukraine is on the front line of that conflict.
Now, we understood that in 2017, the first year of the Trump administration, and it appeared the Trump administration understood it as well. And we understood it in 2018, and the Trump administration understood that as well. And we understood that in 2019, and the Trump administration appeared to as well. At least it did until it didn't. It did until something of greater importance and significance came along. And that event of greater significance to the Oval Office was the emergence of Joe Biden as a candidate for president. And then that military support, which had increased during the Trump administration, was suddenly put on hold for inexplicable reasons. Ukraine got the message. It wasn't very inexplicable to Ukraine. And what's more, Russia got the message. It wasn't very inexplicable to Russia. That had pushed out the whole propaganda theory that it was Ukraine that had interfered in our election and not Russia. And so that consensus among the Congress and the administration, among the right and the left and the center, that as Ambassador Taylor explained, this is not only vital to Ukraine's security and the post-World War II order that has kept the peace in Europe for 70 years, but it's vital to us and our security as well. That all broke down. That all broke down over an effort led by the president and his agent, Rudy Giuliani, and his agents, Parnas and Fruman, to overturn all of that. Overturn a decades-long commitment to standing up to Russian aggression. We have so tremendously benefited. No country has benefited more from the international rules of the road, the international order, than the United States. It gave us the peace and stability to prosper like no other nation has before. And we're throwing it away. We're throwing it away. We're undermining the rule of law. We're undermining the principle you don't invade your neighbor. We're undermining the key to our own success. And for what? For help with a political campaign. To quote Bill Taylor, that's crazy. That's crazy. If our allies can't trust us to stand behind them in a time of need, we will soon not have a single ally left. Look, I know it's painful to see some of our allies and how they talk about this president, because when they talk about this president, they're also talking about the United States. And it's painful to see our allies distance themselves from the United States. And it's more than painful, it's dangerous. It's dangerous to us. I think it was Churchill once said, there's nothing worse than allies except having no allies. But if we're going to condition our support for our allies on their willingness to be dragged, kicking and screaming into our politics. If we're going to condition the strength of our alliance on whether they'll help us cheat in an election, we're not going to have a single ally left. And not a single one of us in this chamber is ever going to be able to say one of our counterparts to respect the rule of law without it being thrown in our face. Promoting the rule of law and fighting corruption is central to our foreign policy. It distinguishes U.S. global leadership from the transactional approach favored by authoritarian adversaries. The inherently corrupt nature of the president's demand that Ukraine investigate his political opponent undermined the credibility of efforts to promote the rule of law and combat corruption in Ukraine and around the world. Indeed, the president engaging in the very conduct at home that our policy fights abroad sabotages long-standing bipartisan pillars of American diplomacy. This was a problem, not least because the pervasive corruption with Ukraine leaves its politics and economy susceptible to Russian influence and subterfuge. Ambassador Yovanovitch emphasized that U.S. policy in Ukraine has long recognized that the struggle against corruption and defending against Russia are in fact two sides of the very same coin.
Corruption makes Ukraine's leaders ever vulnerable to Russia, and the Ukrainian people understand that. That's why they launched the Revolution of Dignity in 2014, demanding to be a part of Europe, demanding the transformation of the system, demanding to live under the rule of law. Ukrainians wanted the law to apply equally to all people, whether the individual in question is the president or any other citizen. It was a question of fairness, of dignity. Here again, there is a coincidence of interests. Corrupt leaders are inherently less trustworthy, while an honest and accountable Ukrainian leadership makes a U.S.-Ukrainian partnership more reliable and more valuable to the United States. A level playing field in this strategically located country bordering four NATO allies creates an environment in which U.S. business can more easily trade, invest, and profit. Corruption is also a security issue because corrupt officials are vulnerable to Moscow.
During that conversation that we related in the past when Ambassador Volker urged his Ukrainian counterpart, Andrei Yermak, not to investigate the past president of Ukraine, and Yermak threw it back in his face. You remember the conversation. No, you mean like the investigation you want us to do of the Clintons and the Bidens. They taught us something in that conversation. They taught us that we'd forgotten, for that moment, our own values. You know, just listening to the ambassador right now, I was thinking how interesting it is the Ukrainians chose to describe their revolution as a revolution of dignity. And maybe that's what we need here, a revolution of dignity at home, a revolution of civility here at home. Maybe we can learn a lot more from our Ukrainian ally. In short, it is America's national security interest to help Ukraine transform into a country where the rule of law governs and corruption is held in check. As we heard yesterday, anti-corruption policy was a central part of the talking points provided to President Trump before his phone calls with President Zelensky on April 21st and July 25th. President Trump, of course, didn't mention corruption, but importantly, those same foreign policy goals remained intact following the call. As Tim Morrison testified, anti-corruption reforms, institutional reforms remain a top U.S. priority to help Ukraine fight corruption. President Zelensky was swept into office on an anti-corruption platform. Immediately, he kept his promise and introduced numerous bills in Ukraine's parliament. In a sign that he intended to hold himself accountable, Zelensky even introduced a draft law on presidential impeachment. He also introduced a bill to restore punishment of top officials found guilty of illicit enrichment. President Trump's self-serving scheme threatened to undermine Zelensky's anti-corruption work. Zelensky's successful anti-corruption reforms would have advanced U.S. security. Instead, President Trump's demands undermined that effort to bring about reform to Ukraine. Here's George Kent, a rule of law and corruption expert at the State Department.
U.S. efforts to counter corruption in Ukraine focus on building institutional capacity so that the Ukrainian government has the ability to go after corruption and effectively investigate, prosecute, and judge alleged criminal activities using appropriate institutional mechanisms. That is, to create and follow the rule of law. That means that if there are criminal nexuses for activity in the United States, U.S. law enforcement should pursue the case. If we think there's been a criminal act overseas that violates U.S. law, we have the institutional mechanisms to address that. It could be through the Justice Department and FBI agents assigned overseas, or through treaty mechanisms, such as the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. As a general principle, I do not believe the United States should ask other countries to engage in selective, politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, because such selective actions undermine the rule of law, regardless of the country.
And so it's clear what President Trump did when abusing his office and demanding Ukraine open an investigation into Joe Biden was not fighting corruption. It was not part of established U.S. anti-corruption policy. That corrupt pressure campaign for his own personal political benefit, in fact, subverted U.S. anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine and undercut our national security. President Trump was not fighting to end corruption in Ukraine. As my colleague in the House, Mr. Himes, pointed out during one of our hearings, he was trying to aim corruption in Ukraine at Vice President Biden and our 2020 election. Selective, politically motivated prosecutions of political opponents undercut governance in Ukraine. President Trump's demand that Zelensky help him do precisely what U.S. diplomats for decades advised Ukrainian officials not to do completely undercut the credibility of efforts to promote the rule of law there. The demand also undercut the United States' moral standing and authority in the eyes of a global audience. Here, once again, is George Kent.
Ken, is pressuring Ukraine to conduct what I believe you've called political investigations a part of U.S. foreign policy to promote the rule of law in Ukraine and around the world?
It is not.
Is it in the national interest of the United States?
In my opinion, it is not.
Why not?
Because our policies, particularly in promoting the rule of law, are designed to help countries, and in Eastern Europe and Central Europe, that is overcoming the legacy of communism. In the communist system, in particular, the Prosecutor General Office was used to suppress and persecute citizens, not promote the rule of law. So in helping these countries reach their own aspirations to join the Western community of nations and live lives of dignity, helping them have the rule of law with strong institutions is the purpose of our policy.
So in other words, it is a purpose of our foreign policy to encourage foreign nations to refrain from conducting political investigations. Is that right?
Correct. And in fact, as a matter of policy, not of programming, we oftentimes raise our concerns, usually in private, with countries that we feel are engaged in selective political prosecution and persecution of their opponents.
Yovanovitch aptly summarized the global consequences and harm to U.S. national security resulting from President Trump's demand that Ukraine investigate his political opponent.
Such conduct undermines the U.S., exposes our friends, and widens the playing field for autocrats like President Putin. Our leadership depends on the power of our example and the consistency of our purpose. Both have now been opened to question.
The issues I just covered are not a matter of policy disagreement over foreign policy and national security.